I am here with David Frum. David, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
It's been a while. I feel like we speak more than we do because I just consume your stuff over at the Atlantic, so I know what you're thinking about, but I think it's been some years since we've done a podcast together.
I think that's right. Since then, I've ventured into your domain. I've started a podcast of my own, and I want to salute you. I think I always knew that it was not easy. I didn't know how not easy it was.
Right.
So Maestro, you know how it's done, and I take my hat off to you.
Oh, nice. Well, congratulations on the show. It's the David Frum Show over at the Atlantic.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
That's fantastic. Well, let's jump into the current moment. We're what, 6 or so months into the second Trump administration.
Yeah.
There's a lot we could talk about. Where the fires of controversy are currently raging on the about the Epstein case.
Yeah.
Trump and his courtiers have been amazingly inept at putting those fires out, and I would love to know the reasons why you think that is. But let's start with just the big picture on the domestic front. How has it been these last 6 months from your point of view, and what has surprised you? What has been worse than you thought? What has been better than you thought?
Yeah. Well, here is the thing that has been worse than I thought, and this is one of the two or three biggest stories, which is the corruption has been on a fantastically larger scale than anything I imagined or anything that I was ready for from the first Trump administration.
Yeah.
In the first Trump administration, Trump used techniques like making the Secret Service follow him around to his various resorts. He used techniques like making sure that any Republican candidate who wanted his blessing had to use one of his facilities. He pressed foreign governments that needed American favor to use his facilities for their National Day events and to stay. He would ask diplomats who visited him, where did you stay last night? But over that probably moved some single millions of dollars into his pocket, maybe something over $10 million. There are different estimates in the first term. So in the second term, he has left all, we're talking now, much vaster sums of money through the meme coins. As you and I speak, the President Trump is about to go to Scotland to open a new golf course of his own. He's got golf courses in Vietnam and other countries that seek America's favor. So all of that is bigger by a factor of 10 or 100 than it was in the first term. So that's one thing that has changed. A second thing that has changed is the trade disputes of the first term were definitely a problem that hurt Americans. Before Trump became president, the United States was the largest exporter of soybeans in the world. And over the first Trump term, it fell into second place behind Brazil because Trump alienated so many soybean buyers. But the trade disruptions we are seeing and the threat to the American economy and the world economy, that's much bigger. The damage to alliances is much bigger. And of course, the shock to America's future standing from this enormous debt that Trump is incurring through his fiscal measures, that's much bigger.
Yeah, and also some of those indiscretions are linked, right? So the trade disruptions seem, in many cases, to be motivated by Trump's personal corruption, right? I mean, you cited Vietnam, right? So the reason to slap a 46% tariff on Vietnam is that their remedy for that is to immediately greenlight a $1.5 billion Trump family resort deal.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm speaking to you right now from Canada, which has been a special target of Trump's animosity. And a lot of people in Canada are sort of baffled, like, what the hell happened here? What did Canada do? Canada's linked to the United States. Canada signed all these trade agreements. It signed a new trade agreement with the United States that was signed by Donald Trump. He's just ignored that. And I think a big part of the Canadian problem is the Trump Organization had two hotels in Canada, one in Toronto and one in Vancouver, and they both went bust. The Toronto hotel, Trump just licensed his name, and it went bust for sort of semi-objective economic reasons during the Great Recession or soon after. But the Vancouver hotel went bust. Trump owned it and operated it. It went bust because Vancouverites wouldn't set foot in his building during his first term. And he seems to be really mad about that and is blowing up the North American common market or the North American trading zone to punish Vancouver for not liking his hotel more.
So why is it, in your view, that half of America appears not to care about this? Is the problem that people don't know any of the facts you just elucidated, or they've heard about them, but they think it's fake news, or they understand exactly the shape and scope of this corruption? They understand that the meme coin is a device for the paying of bribes directly to the first family. They know that really there is no precedent in American history for a president to use U.S. trade policy and foreign policy as a mechanism by which to extract tribute from foreign governments. Yeah. And essentially, he's running a protection racket. And it's both internationally, where he's putting the global economy at risk for his personal gain, and it's domestically, where he's shaking down some of our largest corporations. I mean, we have news organizations settling spurious lawsuits that they were almost certain to win, but this is a way of just funneling money in Trump's direction and hopefully getting his favor on future deals. Is it that people know all of this and simply do not care? I mean, what's your interpretation of half of America that still supports Trump?
Well, I don't think we should be so surprised that this would happen. Look, American politics has always been deeply tribal. This has been a two-party system, more or less, for almost all of its political existence. Now, who's in the tribes changes from time to time. And the tribes are always remaking themselves, but they're two big tribes. And I think the way to think about how strong these tribal loyalties are. So 1932 is probably one of the worst years in American history. Bottom of the Great Depression. Americans are literally going hungry. Incumbent President Herbert Hoover, who presided over the disaster, ran for re-election in 1932 and got 38% of the vote.
There's a core 35% that's just unmovable. Yeah.
It's called the base for a reason. It doesn't move. And if you ask people in 1932, look, you know, things are terrible. Why are you voting for President Herbert Hoover? They would have deep reasons of identity. Well, my grandfather was at Antietam under Grant, and we vowed we will always vote Republican no matter what. Hmm. Or the Democrats are the party of the Catholic Church, or the Democrats are the party of liquor. So we don't care about these economic facts. We are voting for the Union against the Catholic Church, against liquor. And that's why this household votes Republican in 1932. And there you could tell the same story about Democrats. So elections are always decided at the margins. And I think that's one of the reasons that Donald Trump is so freaked out about the Epstein story. Because that is one of those rare events that can shake up the tribal structure and move people from column A to column B. Because Trump has already told them, or Trump talkers and validators have told them, this is the biggest scandal in the world. It's the most important scandal in the world. And only Donald Trump can get to the bottom of it. And it's as if, I'm going to borrow an analogy from my son, it's as if they built a giant device of paranoia and fear and rage and hatred and never thought to ask, in whose basement are we building this device? Oh, it's the basement of the guy we think we're supposed to be following. It's in his basement. And when it blows him up, not the people we wanted to blow up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to get to Epstein because it's the one thing, the one controversy that seems to be doing him some damage with the base, or with certainly parts of the base. But before we get there, let's linger on this litany of abuses you have put forward. I mean, there's the additional problem of how needlessly provocative and cruel the immigration crackdown has been. Again, I feel like there are many people who voted for Trump who in the abstract supported some of these policies and would have been even insouciant about his corruption because they just think, oh, well, it's more or less the same thing all politicians do. You know, Nancy Pelosi made some stock trades that are hard to explain, et cetera. So they just put it all in the same bin. I mean, they're insensitive to the scale of the problem, right? $1 million is the same as $1 billion, really, if you're going to look at it that lazily. But I think many people are genuinely surprised by the optics of the immigration crackdown. Yeah. Has the implementation of this policy struck you? And why does it seem, frankly seems reckless. I'm surprised by how ruthless and chaotic they seem to want to be in the implementation of this policy.
Yes. No, that's a very important question. I should have mentioned it at the opening. And it's one that hits me especially hard. Because I have been arguing for a long time that America needs a stronger border policy. And this is before the surge of 2020. This is before even the surge of 2014. I've been writing this since the 1990s. Mm-hmm. My view has always been immigration, if done right, is a great benefit to a country. So it's very important to do it right. Because if you do it wrong, you will get a backlash. And the backlash will be even worse than a failed immigration policy.
So I'll remind you of your own famous line. I mean, many of us have made this point, but you made it most sententiously. You said, I believe, if liberals won't police borders, fascists will.
Right. All right. And you get Brexit and you get other forms of self-harm. So it's been, and so I was, my first article about the Biden administration when it took over in January of 2021 was they began undoing many of the Trump restrictions on the border that had kept people from flowing across. I said, this is the first and biggest mistake they make. If they undo this, they are courting a lot of damage because the whole world wants to come to the United States. And if you don't police the border, you'll have the problem. The answer, people like me insisted, was the way you enforce the border is not at the border, it's at the workplace. And what you should have a system where when an employer is looking to hire people, there's a requirement the employer check that they're legal in the country, the same way that the employer should check that they're not a minor, in the same way the employer should check that they actually work the number of hours that are legally allowed to be worked, and that there should be consequences for the employer. If you should treat immigration as another aspect of labor law, and if employers get the message that the government is checking whether the employees are legal, there will be less incentive for people to enter the country in the first place. And the reason I was so emphatic about this over many, many articles was if you start, because the alternative is our walls and roundups, and the country won't stand for it. We are seeing scenes that shock the conscience. We've got this network now of camps that are being built in which people have not been convicted of any crime or just here illegally in the country, which is not a crime. It's a violation of status, but it's not a crime to be in the country illegally. It's against the law, but a lot, you know, so is driving recklessly, not necessarily a crime. They're rounding up people. They're removing status from categories of people like Venezuelans and others who were granted temporary protected status, who thought they did the right thing and who now find themselves without status and subject to being dragged to a camp. The country won't wear this. And Trump is going to create a situation where, in addition to all of the terrible suffering that people have done nothing really wrong other than break a labor law to make a better life, they're in camps. He's also going to change the political structure about immigration in this country in a way that is going to be to his own harm and those of the people who follow him.
Do you actually think that the country won't put up with it? I mean, haven't we shown an inclination to put up with it thus far? I mean, obviously there are people, you know, a handful of people in the streets of Los Angeles who, at least for a time, showed some signs of not putting up with it. But in terms of the way the rest of the country views the so-called sanctuary cities where these raids are happening, I feel like it's not even an acquiescence. There's basically at least perceived full acceptance of it as this is what you liberals get. I mean, you wanted your nannies and your housekeepers and your gardeners to be as cheap as possible. We don't have the same black market economy and that kind of labor over here in Ohio or Pennsylvania. You're getting what you deserve, and we wanted these people out of the country.
Well, as I said, the base doesn't change, but here are two things to keep in mind. One is there is a lot of polling about how attitudes toward immigration, which hardened during the Biden administration, are softening under Trump, quite dramatically so. And the second thing to keep in mind is one of the reasons that Donald Trump won the presidency with an actual plurality of the vote in 2024, unlike 2016, was that quite a number of Hispanics, especially Hispanic men, moved in his direction.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to forget the statistic off the top of my head, and I probably shouldn't quote statistics off the top of my head anyway, but what percentage of Hispanic voters have a relative who is in the country without status, but it's high? And Hispanics are not immigration single issue voters. That was a big mistake that Jeb Bush made back in 2011 and 12 to believe, or sorry, 15, 16 to believe that they would be single issue voters on immigration. That's not true. And many Hispanics welcome more enforcement. But if you're rounding up their mother-in-law and putting her in a camp, that's going to be a problem. And it's going to be a problem with people, with voters that were trending Trump and that Trump needed to keep.
Do you think we're just getting started in the unveiling of this ugliness, or is this have we seen the sort of the peak of what is morally outrageous?
And in the immigration section, we've built a new bureaucracy. ICE is soon to be bigger than the Marine Corps, if I read the numbers right.
Yeah.
And you can't build up a law enforcement agency that fast without terrible risks. So the bureaucratic machinery that is built is going to keep chomping, and there will be more and more terrible stories. And first, people will read about them, and then they will hear about them, and then they may feel them. And then you'll have cases where a family, some of whose members are in the country legally, has other members who are in the camps. And so it's not just going to be the Fox News audience. It's not just going to be, you know, the diehard voter for one side or another. It's going to be people who were potential Republicans who are going to say, well, I would have been, but now my mother-in-law's in a camp. I'm not voting for that.
So what else strikes you as surprising from the first 6 months? We've got three. I'll remind you, we have 3.5 years left, right? So many things. I have to remind myself of this because I keep noticing that I'm living with a kind of political illusion that the shape of the thing is already fully manifest, whereas it's obviously evolving hour by hour, and who knows what we're going to be talking about a year from now.
Yeah. Well, let's start with some things that are not as bad as they could be, so we don't sink too deep into the gloom. Ukraine is still fighting. Trump is obviously not sympathetic to Ukraine. Vice President Vance, even more hostile to Ukraine, but he has not stopped the Ukrainian forces from fighting, and weapons and support do continue to trickle to Ukraine. There are interruptions, but they're getting something, and it looks like they may get some more stuff. Again, not enough, not as much as they should have, not maybe enough to win, but enough not to lose. I have to say, as a supporter of the State of Israel, I have been impressed and grateful that the Trump administration has improved the already generous support for Israel that the Biden administration gave. And that has led to some decisive results. I think also I had thought the uncertainty that Trump was creating about trade would move us faster to recession, but the opposite seems to be happening. It's because Trump, he does something dumb and then he retracts it. He does something else dumb and then he retracts it. And I thought the market would say, well, in that case, we have to stop investing altogether because who knows what the future is. But the market keeps hoping for the best and paying more attention to the retractions of the dumb policy than the dumb policy. So we're not in a recession, it looks like, right now in the summer of 2025. It doesn't seem so. And we hope that maybe we can get through the rest of this year without too much of a recession. So that would be a good thing if we could avoid that.
Although it does seem, on its face, completely irrational. The market seems to have drawn the lesson that there's actually less uncertainty now than there was before so-called Liberation Day, right? I mean, all of this lurching back and forth seems to have convinced the market that this is better than it was 4 months ago.
Yeah. Well, the Trump trade policy has failed to, and as predicted, to do what it pretended to want to do. What it's pretended to want to do is to bring back manufacturing to the United States. And that is doomed to fail for two reasons. One is, if you're producing something where your costs are higher than a Chinese or Vietnamese competitor, and the government says, okay, we'll protect you from the competition, you're safe. It doesn't matter that your costs are 20% or 30% or 40% higher than the Chinese or Vietnamese, we're going to put up a wall to protect you. To which the investor will say, okay, but the investment I'm contemplating is a very big one, and it's going to take quite a lot of years to pay itself off. Can you assure me that this protection is going to be in place for the next 15 years?
Yeah.
Because I'm not making this investment unless I'm guaranteed 15 years of protection. And obviously Trump can't protect that. And so we have seen business investment not responding. The second thing, and this is a point that the Trump people will not understand, and that you can't get protectionists to understand, every product is also an input. So when you raise the price of a product, you are making of one step in the industrial process, you're raising every price. So fine, when you protect steel and protect it from foreign competition, and you then say, we also want to bring back shipping to the United States, what do you think ships are made of?
Yeah.
You've raised the cost of the ship. So you pretty soon, it's like the house that Jack built. And when America was more protectionist back in the 19th century, this was all that politics was about. The wool people would want protection. So the coats would need protection. The coat people would get protection. So every industry that used coats would need protection, and so on forever. And one of the reasons that the United States changed and abandoned the protectionist policy was to say, you can't protect everything, but you must protect everything if this is going to work. And the whole thing is crazy and dysfunctional and expensive, so don't do it.
Hmm. Well, as you said, there are a few, if not silver linings, there are things that are not as bad as one would have feared. I mean, the change of posture with respect to Ukraine since that awful Oval Office meeting with Zelensky has been good, although it hasn't been principled. I mean, there's been this deterioration in his love affair with Putin simply because Putin keeps humiliating him. And so we're seeing, again, U.S. foreign policy get bent by the brain chemistry of the lone maniac in the Oval Office. Who perceives everything through the politics of personal slights and flattery and the payments of tribute, et cetera. So, you know, who knows what policy will change as a result of the next insult or the next piece of flattery. And one hopes that there's a more principled stance underwriting his support for Israel. I mean, he has, you know, on balance, always been quite supportive of Israel, and that would explain his popularity there, except that he has shown signs of, again, just being pushed around by any perceived slight. I mean, I remember in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, I think the first thing he had to say about that atrocity was something petty about, you know, Netanyahu not, you know, treating him well. I mean, one can only imagine, had the mullahs in Iran offered him a sufficiently large golf course deal, we might have a different policy with respect to the Middle East right now.
I think we have another big problem with coming with Iran, which is, look, I think we all hope that the Trump actions against Iran were decisive and that we've reached the end of the story, that he's done significant damage to their nuclear program and we can close the books on this for a long time. But what if that's not true? What if either the damage was not as total as Trump said, or the mullahs have other tricks to play, whether that's regional, whether that's global terrorism, whether it's something. What if this is a problem that requires more work than just press a button, collect the accolades, forget about it? The whole Trump foreign policy idea is you do something once and then it's over and you're a winner and you give yourself a parade. But foreign policy doesn't work that way. And one of the ways I think we should consider when we're trying to think, how serious are the threats to the United States from what's happening today? One of the questions asked is, how difficult will it be to undo? So the good news about the Trump corruption is actually you can, as happened in the 1970s, you can have a period of cleanup. So you could have a 4 or 5 years where both Congress and state legislators say, okay, we have the corruption got out of hand, and we're going to pass rules to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. You can dial it back. You can fix it up. American politics is sometimes more clean, sometimes less clean. We're in a dirty period. You can have a clean period. Mm-hmm. The damage to world trade is not so easily fixed. If Ukraine goes under, that's not fixed. If you get a long-term conflict with Iran that's bigger than the one we've had, and above all, and this is the most important thing, if American leadership is questioned by the allies who benefit from it, by the adversaries who used to fear it, I don't know how quickly you get that back. That's a hard thing to reassert.
Yeah, I don't know how you get it back, given that whatever we do to get it back, I mean, just imagine the next president, who's presumably, if he did this or she did this, would not be J.D. Vance, just offers this omnibus mea culpa on behalf of the nation, saying, we're terribly sorry we did this to you. Trump was a monstrosity. He was a gift to our enemies and an enemy to our friends. We want a hard reset of all of our relationships, and we were going to resume something like a normal role of leadership and collegiality with all other liberal democracies. The problem is that there's one bell that cannot be unrung here, which is that we have announced to the world that within any 4-year political cycle, we are capable of reneging on everything. We're capable of producing a tsunami of corruption and stupidity, the likes of which no one could have expected. And I mean, it's impossible to exaggerate. We can befriend dictators. We can claim that the victims of a war of aggressions actually started the war. I mean, there's just up is down and down is up. And we are capable as a nation of, given all the protections against this that one would have thought existed against this, we are capable of doing this on a dime in response to a 51% vote. Right. And who knows when we're going to do this to you again.
And it's happened twice.
Right.
So let me give you some concrete examples of things that I think are going to be with us for a long time. With the European allies, whom Trump is so hostile to, there are deep commonalities of history, of culture, legal systems. You know, the British, the Germans, they'll probably forgive the United States sooner or later. But the great challenge to American power in this present century, will be China. And of course, China's neighborhood is very different. The allies you need to balance China are countries that don't have that kind of affinity. Vietnam has no sentimentality about America's role in Vietnamese history. The Indonesians don't have much. The Indians have zero. The Filipinos may have like a little, but not much. Hmm. So what all of these people are wondering about is, the Chinese are close, you're far. The Chinese and you are about equally strong. You say you will protect us if things get tough. Can we trust you? And the American answer is about 50% of the time, yes. Yeah, we're good for 50% of the time. And you never know in advance which 50% it's going to be. So the Vietnamese are going to think, and not just the Vietnamese, but even more congenial countries like Australia are going to think, we need to hedge our bets here. We can't be so close to the United States because they're not so reliable. Or here's another concrete problem. Trump has used American weapon sales as a tool of not only national strategy, but personal irritation. So one of the big questions that the Europeans have is the European Union economy is at least equally big to the United States. Europe does not have an arms industry competitive with the United States. And the French government has always said, Europeans should buy European, even if the European weapons aren't at the moment quite as good as the American weapons, because then they won't have to worry about being cut off. So when Trump is saying, you know, we've got a kill switch in every weapon, whether that's true or not, he's the best salesperson the French arms industry ever had. If you're a German, if you're a Pole, and you think, should we buy the French system? I was in a, I won't use the specifics here, I was in a NATO country at the earlier part of this year and had dinner with the defense minister, who was contemplating a major weapons purchase, at least major by the standards of that country. They had a series of bids, one from American, the United States, one from France, one from some other country. The American system was clearly the best, most capable, but it was also the most expensive. And they also had lost confidence that they could trust it. They had heard about this kill switch rumor. Trump hadn't said it yet, but they had heard about it. They were worried about it. And they were going to lean instead to a French or South Korean system because at least they could trust that system. And after all, while it wasn't as good as the American system, it was still better than the Russian system.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you anticipating a new wave of nuclear proliferation as a result of what's happened of late, especially our on-again, off-again support of Ukraine? I mean, it seems to me that the only rational lesson to draw from Ukraine's experience, on the one hand, and maybe you could hold North Korea over as a counterpoint, is that if you want to be guaranteed of not being invaded by your neighbor, really the only way to do that is to have nuclear weapons, right? I mean, this is obviously, you could add Iran to this picture. Are you expecting a half a dozen more countries to suddenly go nuclear in the next decade?
Well, there are two asterisks we have to put beside the proliferation threat. One of the other lessons of the war in Ukraine is that nuclear weapons are a lot less useful than you might think.
Yeah.
Because how much good have they done the Russians? They scared the Biden people out of giving all the weapons they should have as fast as they might have, but not permanently. And they certainly didn't cause the Ukrainians to surrender. And Russia, it wasn't an option to use nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are a weapon of last resort, weapon of existential survival. But the people who want weapons tend to be aggressors, and they're not really useful as tools of aggression. And for the place where you might see proliferation, you know, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, these are countries that have the ability to be all but nuclear pretty easily. And why go that last mile, especially when what you really need is to repel, say, a naval invasion or a cyber attack or pandemic weapons? I'm not sure. I mean, we should keep in mind, you saw the movie Oppenheimer, and remember that scene where they're levering the New Mexico bomb into place with a giant mattress underneath it to catch it, and men in dungarees and sleeveless undershirts hauling it up by rope? I remember sitting in the theater saying, the distance in time from me to that scene is the same as the distance in time from that scene to the Battle of the Monitor and the Merrimack in the Civil War. This is an ancient technology. I'm not sure how useful it really is in the 21st century.
Yeah, although it does seem to prevent conventional attack, right? I mean, when you ask the question, why haven't we done to North Korea what we did to Iran? The difference is North Korea had nukes before it became as bellicose as it became.
Well, not to caveat that too much, but this is, I think, I was fairly close to this story for a while. So, and this is the gift Israel gave to the world. So the North Korean nuclear program became visible in the late 1980s, before it was complete. And there was one crisis under George H.W. Bush and a second crisis, much more intense, in the summer of 1994 under President Clinton. And both of them thought very hard about striking the nuclear facility and putting it out of action before North Korea could go nuclear. And the reason President H.W. Bush and President Clinton, who came even closer than Bush, did not do it was because North Korea had all these artillery tubes and rockets pointed at the South Korean capital, which is only 40 kilometers away from the North Korean border. So the North Korean conventional force deterred the United States from eliminating the nuclear force while there was still time. And what Israel did for the United States was it turned off. It turned off Hezbollah. It turned off the ballistic missiles. It turned off the air defenses. And it just teed up. So the United States could do to Iran in 2025 what it could not do to North Korea in the summer of 1994, which is strike the nuclear program without having to tangle with any of the other elements of that country's power.
Right, right. So how are things for Israel looking, in your view, in terms of actual security at this point? the progress of the war against Hamas, further entanglements with Iran, the uncertainty there. But also what's increasingly worrisome to me is just the pariah status with respect to the rest of the world. I mean, there is an information war here, which has been, to my eye, thoroughly lost for reasons that I think we could probably diagnose. How do those two sides to the conflict appear to you at the moment?
Well, when I think about Israel, and I'm very emotionally connected to it. I had a child who nearly went to live there, and we visit a lot and have family there. Listeners can take that for what they will. So let's look at three envelopes. The first envelope is the strategic envelope, Israel's objective safety and security. It seems to me never better that the destruction or near destruction, if it is destruction of the Iranian nuclear program or the disabling or degrading of the nuclear program, removes the most important existential threat to the state of Israel. And again, the degrading of Hezbollah removes a border threat. And the credibility of what Israel achieved, I think, concentrates minds. So strategically, never more secure. But as you said, there's the factor you raised, which is Israel is a small country. It depends on international trade. It depends on trade with not only the United States and its European neighbors, but with its immediate neighbors in the Middle East. If Israel is delegitimized, that's a real problem. And the last thing, Israel has always had this extraordinary core unity caused by the pressures on the borders of the state. If those pressures relax, there's so many forces of disunion in the country that I worry that those will get out of hand. The challenge of the ultra-Orthodox, the challenge of bringing the Israeli Arab population into full citizenship and full support of the state, true commitment to the state, you know, that the future of Israel depends on reaching a place where the ultra-Orthodox, they do serve in the military, they do pay proper taxes, they're not subsidized indefinitely by the government, and where Israeli Arabs feel a sense of meaningful citizenship and participation in the state and give it their loyalty, even, you know, that they may have a different faith, they may have a different ethnic background, but that they can accept this is our state too, and we give it our loyalty. And with the pressure off the borders, those internal problems may get worse. I worry about that a lot.
Mm. What do you think about the perception of the war outside of Israel, especially on social media, especially among the young, you know, Generation Z? Yeah. It just seems to me that there is so much misinformation.
Yeah.
It's not to say that it hasn't been a very ugly war, but I mean, I don't know what the percentages are now, but I can only imagine that something like a majority among people under 40, certainly left of center in America, would think that, you know, Israel is culpable for a genocide in Gaza.
It is a very important problem. And every democracy needs to understand it's in an information war. The Ukrainians, too. I mean, that in Israel, it's the case of the left of center believing crazy things. In the Ukrainian case, it's the right of center that believes crazy things. Mm. You know, some of them are frivolous, like the rumor that has started on the far right that the president of France is married to a man, which, well, if true, so what? But not true, as it happens. what kind of troll farm thought that's the thing to bring down French support for Ukraine?
It's the troll farm in Candace Owens' brain. That's
I don't think she made that up.
Yeah.
I don't think she made that.
No,
she's
clever enough to have made that up. I mean, she's
that one's so wacky. That one's so wacky. Like, really, that somebody inserted that one. I may be wrong. You may be right. But so these forms of information warfare are really important. And in Israel's case, Israel depends on legitimacy. It's a small country, and it needs friends.
So how do you view the problem of anti-Semitism at this moment globally?
Yeah.
Are you like me in having more or less gone to sleep on this issue as a current problem in your life and the lifetime of your children? I mean, obviously, I know you're probably a student of the Holocaust, as I am, and you're aware of the history. But prior to October 7th, was anti-Semitism very low on your list of concerns, as it was for me?
No. So some biography here. So my father's parents were born in interwar Poland. They came to Canada from Poland in 1930, not because they had any inkling of what was ahead, but because economic conditions were terrible and they had relatives in Canada and were able to come. My father was born in Canada in 1931. Had they not made that decision, my father would have been murdered sometime around his 10th, 11th, or 12th birthday. Mm-hmm. And as was the vast majority, they left most of their family behind, and almost every one of my father's family tree was murdered. A few survived and came to Israel after the war, but almost all were murdered.
Well, just to remind people, something like 95% of the Jews in Poland were murdered. So,
So it was not something, it was one of those things, we didn't talk about it a lot, but it was never not there. And also, because I've been involved in organized Jewish life my whole life, I've never believed there was a good old days. That there are times when, look, there was a time when it was harder to put anti-Semitic content on mass media, for sure. In the days of CBS, ABC, and NBC, you couldn't get a host who would say, you know, I'm going to go for the anti-Semitic niche market, even though I'm sure it was there in 1963 or 1973, but it wasn't served. Today it's served, so it becomes more visible. But I think one of the things that explorers like, you mentioned Candace Owens, have discovered is that was a real market, and it was underserved in the days of less efficient media. Now the media are just better at finding out what their audience wants and getting it to them. And I mean, it is true that we have more incidents. I'm right now speaking to you, as I said, from a small town, and Toronto is 200 kilometers away. There's a serious anti-Semitic incident in Toronto every single day. Mm-hmm. So, and symbolic violence, actual violence, intimidation. I think it's a little better in most American cities, but there people have been murdered in Washington, D.C. But those kinds of things happened in the past, too. And I think I remember the outcry over the war in Lebanon in 1982, when there was the same kind of information war was waged against Israel then as now. And the same kind of effort to intimidate North American Jews into not speaking in defense of Israel. The situation in Europe may be worse, and the migration to the Middle East may have driven that. The deteriorating strength of European states, the weakening of police work, those all go into a factor. But no, one should never assume that these things go away. Nothing goes away. Things sometimes slumber or are not heard from for a while. But this is one of the deepest myths in the history of Western civilization. It's always there, and it's always waiting to be activated. And the question for people in positions of authority is, how hard will they work against those who seek to activate it in the way that so many in media and politics now seek to activate it?
Hmm. What's your perception of the Trump administration's efforts ostensibly targeted at anti-Semitism and illiberal bias on college campuses? One could also worry that it's just targeted against those institutions based on some resentment, you know, more global resentment of them and their elitism. Yeah. But what's your perception of the problem in the ivory tower and the proffered remedy coming from the Trump administration?
Well, you could almost get a novel out of this or an opera, that the authoritarian figure comes along and he says to one minority group, you I like, you're my favorite, you I want to protect. I've got my big club here. I'm going to go club the other groups, and I'm going to shut down many of the institutions that are important to a free society, like universities, that have to be free. If they're going to be free to do smart things, they have to be free to do stupid things too. But you I like. You're safe. Trust me. And it's an interesting problem. Do you accept the promise? You're safe. You I like. Don't worry. Or do you think, you know what? I don't trust that promise. And my safety depends not on the goodwill of a particular person who's in power for a few minutes, especially one as changeable as this one, but on permanent structures of liberal governance. And I think that many of the abuses in the academy that you've talked so much about them, that have multiplied and gotten so much worse over the past generation, the only way out is by reason. They're universities. You have to reason people out of them. You can't club people out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your perception? This is now faded from the news of late, but there was a moment where it was wall-to-wall coverage of Doge and the Elon and his team of incels efforts to bring the spirit of efficiency to the federal government. I mean, all of that seemed, especially when you focus on Elon's conflicts of interest, just spectacularly corrupt.
Yeah,
and to say nothing of clumsy and reckless. You know, one can only imagine they cut the wrong wires in dozens of places. We're going to slowly realize what the consequences of those efforts were. The dismantling of USAID was the most conspicuous and I think the most morally abhorrent, despite the fact that they did find a few projects there that were made for right-wing television. I guess let's bring the brief political career of an ascendancy of Elon into this. How did you perceive that moment and his subsequent breakup with the president? Offered, I think, some useful lessons if one wanted to draw them of how tenuous a assurances and from an alliance with the president can be?
Well, I'm speaking here to someone who's the expert on the mind of Elon Musk, mm-hmm. so I'm going to speak with caution. And you've had such a role on this, and you've brought so much light to bear on this strange and subject. It has to be said about Elon Musk, it's one of these great tragic stories that if he had 5 years ago said, you know what, I'm just retiring, I'm going to focus on my collection of butterflies, that he would have left behind a reputation as one of the greatest figures in the history of American business and technology.
Yeah.
He'd be there with Andrew Carnegie and Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. And, you know, you'd be studying his career in business school and there'd be things named for him. He would be a great American industrial hero.
Just think that Walter Isaacson ended his biography before basically everything we're tempted to talk about could even be thought about. It was before Twitter.
That's true.
You know?
True.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is in a way an American tragedy. And he's one of the most interesting people. Like Trump, I've always said, is not actually as a person that interesting.
Right.
But Musk is and Vance is because they had potential. So Doge, government's full of waste. But it's full of waste for a reason. Government is trying to do two or three things that contradict each other. And somebody is put in a law or a remedy. So things like the sugar program, you know, that the United Americans pay much more for sugar than anybody else in the world because there's supply management and you can't bring in sugar. And so then this whole crazy fructose or corn syrup industry has grown up under the sugar protection. And the whole thing is crazy and stupid and wasteful and bad for everybody's health. But you can't just issue, it's not there for no reason because nobody wants it and nobody protects it. People want it. Not many people, but a small number of people have powerful incentive to protect it. So if you're going to fight these instances of government waste, it takes a real political strategy. You have to know why the program is there, how it happened, and then you have to build your political coalition that is focused enough and big enough. Because if you wave your magic wand, it's not going to go away. Now, Musk achieved some things for himself permanently. He was worried about Securities and Exchange Commission investigations of his enterprises, and those seem to have been shut down. And he was worried about Internal Revenue Service investigations. And he's dismantled much of the enforcement apparatus, the IRS, especially against upper-income individuals. So he got some of the things he wanted. But when government spends too much, when government spends wastefully on defense, it's not because they're crooked. It's because there's someone who said, this base is really important to my congressional district. And even though it makes no sense in the greater scheme of things, I will defend it and I will build a coalition. And if you want to close that base, you need to, in the basis, we know what you had to build a base closing commission and isolate it from Congress and take 10 years. And eventually you could shut down some bases. But so Musk, what was tragic is this man who had so many gifts, he didn't understand what the problem was that he was trying to solve. He didn't understand why the problem was there, how the problem was built. He just assumed he could wish the problem away. And of course, all he did was suspend delivery of anti-HIV drugs to hundreds of thousands of African people, especially children, whose lives could be saved by those drugs.
Mm. What do you make of the fact that when Elon broke with Trump, and this will bring us to the topic of Epstein inevitably, but when the breakup happened, Trump threatened him explicitly. He even threatened, he said that if Elon backed Democrats in the future, there would be, quote, very serious consequences.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a startling moment for me. I mean, I'm on some level, you know, these two clowns deserve each other. So I didn't lose a lot of sleep over the implications for Elon's, you know, businesses, et cetera. But the fact that we have a sitting U.S. president personally threatening a citizen, if that citizen supports the rival political party in the future, that is so far beyond what is not just normal, conceivable in America. And yet it seemed to me that most people, even Elon's friends, just kind of accepted it as this is normal. This is the new America here. This is how MAGA governs.
As so often with Trump, you're weighing two things. On the other hand, just as you say, unbelievably sinister, unbelievably un-American, unbelievably dangerous and improper. Also, unbelievably reckless, stupid, and dumb. Because do you need to say to a government contractor who dealing with Donald Trump that I could do I'm the kind of person who retaliates? There's a saying, it's attributed to many people in American politics, but that you should never write what you can say, mm-hmm. never say what you can nod, never nod what you can wink, and never wink what the other fellow knows already.
Right.
So why did Trump say these things?
Yeah.
And my guess is that when and if you threaten somebody like Elon Musk, his reaction is not to be intimidated, but to think, well, what's my plan to hit back, which I'm not going to be fool enough to publish. And that's why I think Elon Musk leaned into the Epstein business, because even though Elon Musk's private life has also been kind of a mess, he seems to be completely unentangled with this mess, mm-hmm. whereas Trump is deeply entangled with it. And I don't know. I think their potential, I mean, you could see, I'm sure the mind of Elon Musk is thinking about how does he operationalize things that are embarrassing to Trump if Trump does things to him.
All right. So on the list of things that are embarrassing to Trump, apparently there are some things in the so-called Epstein file that the man does not want released. I mean, or at least that seems to be the only plausible interpretation of current behavior. How do you view this Epstein controversy and the effect it's having on the MAGA faithful? I'm surprised that it hasn't gone away at this point. And I think if I remember who I was a week ago, I recognized that this was a thing. It was sort of delicious. You know, the Schadenfreude circuits were firing in my brain. I mean, this is MAGA getting more or less what they deserve. You know, all the Pizzagate and QAnon lunatics who have gazed upon this hyper object for now a decade, imagining that a pedophile cult runs the world. It's really quite delightful that Trump, their imagined savior, is not only implicated at the bottom of this morass, but is the one who is telling them that they should move on. They're idiots. I don't know. I don't even want your support anymore if you care about this this topic. And he's doing it so badly that it just suggests that they're panicking over there. So what do you think is happening?
Well, I think I follow very much in your footsteps on this, that I read a lot of history, a lot of political history. And one of the lessons of political history is stupidity and carelessness and bad luck are incredibly powerful forces. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that appear to be conspiracies are the products of the illusion, which is politicians say trillions of things and trillions of things happen. And you can look back, once you know how the story went, you can look back and highlight, circle this trillion, this of one of many trillions of things that was said, and this of one of many trillion things that happened, and say they must have been connected. Although at the time, there was just, you know, part of the great vapor of things said and the great confusion of things done. So the pattern is imposed by the mind backwards, even though it was not visible to anybody at the time. So that's my normal instinct. Then he starts acting like a Columbo villain in the last 10 minutes when Columbo is giving him the clue and he scrabbles back to the house to hide the gun inside the lamp. You think, holy cow, like, okay, I didn't believe there was a lamp. I didn't believe there was a gun, but he believes there's a lamp and he believes there's a gun. He's certainly acting like it. And it does look like consciousness of guilt seems to be there. And then you wonder, the part of the story, and there's so many parts of the story. One of the biggest Epstein talkers has been Donald Trump Jr. I mean, he's tweeted about it so many times. I can't even count. I've tried to do a tally, but because Elon Musk broke the search function on Twitter, I can no longer tell you how. Once upon a time, I could have, but now I can't. But did Donald Trump Jr. not know? Really? Am I supposed to believe that? That he didn't know that his father had this relationship? I mean, it looks like, in many ways, that Epstein was the closest thing to a friend that Donald Trump ever had in his sad, solitary, predatory life. Did his son not know that? Or maybe his son did know that. And he's doing something very complicated and psychological and all along. I mean, that's where this story gets so strange.
Mm. And what about there are other characters here who kind of crank the machinery of conspiracy theory for years. I mean, that's what made them so prominent. I'm thinking of obviously Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, only to get into office and then to pivot on their heels and say, there's nothing to see here. Believe me, he committed suicide. I've seen, I saw the file. And yet I came into this assuming, I think I still assume, if I had to bet, I still think Epstein probably committed suicide. He certainly had abundant reasons to commit suicide in my point of view. But it just seems to me that none of these people are acting like they have nothing to hide. I mean, if there was really nothing in those files, if it was really obvious that he committed suicide, if there was no there, it just seems to me that people would speak about all of this differently. I mean, they would be much looser, be much more voluble in how they would deny people the information they want. I mean, they could say, listen, there's a lot in these files that it would be inappropriate to air. I can assure you that there's nothing that suggests he didn't commit suicide. But what is in there are the names of lots of people who are completely innocent, but who've been mentioned in transcripts, blah, blah, blah. Pam right. Bondi could talk for a half hour about why she's not going to give you any more information. And she could be loose about it and, you know, extemporaneous and obviously credible. And so could Kash Patel. So could Dan Bongino. Apparently, they can do none of that because there's something, it's like they have some set of objects in their imagination that they can, that their sentences cannot touch. And they just can't walk this tightrope verbally in real time in front of any audience.
Look, to bring this home to people who don't look at these things for a living, there are lots of reasons why prosecutors don't tell you what's in their files. A prosecutor will investigate a case, and along the way, he'll discover many discreditable things about many people. He will discover that one of the witnesses is cheating on her husband. He will discover that another of the witnesses bribed his commanding officer to get him a citation of valor in war. But prosecutors are not roving one man, one woman, do justice squads. They're there to investigate crimes. And if they get to the end of the investigation, say, we don't have enough evidence here to file a charge against somebody, we're not going to blow up their marriage because we failed to prove the crime. We're not going to destroy their credibility or their citation. Those are bad things that we know about, but we used our law enforcement powers to find them. And that's not how we do justice. So if we can't indict you, we leave alone all the other bad things we discovered about you, and especially the cooperating witnesses. And we may have used the fake citation to get the witness to cooperate, but we don't use that. We don't punish them by publishing it. So there's reasons why these things are supposed to be under seal. They find out a lot of stuff that would hurt people that's not relevant to their job of prosecuting and punishing actual crimes. So I'm not unsympathetic to why a lot of this was kept confidential. But what I am just baffled that the Trump people had to know this stuff. And one of the things that is so weird about a lot of the reporting, like the New York Times stories in particular, they are taking things that have been known since 2011. Mm. And there's this effort. We have to repackage it and pretend that this is all new, because for some reason, not enough people cared about it at the time. And the Trump people pretend it didn't happen. And so because they denied it, you can now package it as a new story. But the relationship between Trump and Epstein, that's just been a notorious fact. Now, it did end in about 2004-5. But my guess is—
It ended not for reasons of moral scrupulosity on Trump's part. It ended because they both wanted to buy the same house in Palm Beach, if memory serves, and they just had a rivalry over a real estate transaction.
Yeah, and I'm also going to bet, again, I don't want to generalize here, hazard a stereotype or anything like that, but I'm guessing if you're friends with a guy who's into creepy sex stuff, and you're friends with him when he's 40, and you're not friends with him when he's 60, I'm guessing he's probably doing more of the creepy sex stuff at age 40 than he's doing at age 60.
Yeah.
So
especially when you have a quote which references the one difference between the two of you, though you both have this bottomless appetite for beautiful women, he likes them younger than you do. It seems to me that suggests knowledge of the proclivities of this friend of yours who you've had for your 15 years.
Yes. So didn't the Trump people know all of this? There's a kind of like recklessness that really does need to be, like, why they built this is the central story in their conspiracy theory about the world. Did they not know? Do they take their supporters so much for granted? Or do some of them have a kind of hidden aggression against Trump, thinking, you know, I'm actually putting a kind of pressure on him? I mean, when you think about the letter, the document that the Wall Street Journal released, I'm not going to hypothesize who released it. But it's not an enormous universe of people who would have access to this book that Ghislaine Maxwell put together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so what are you expecting of the next 6 months, 3 years? When you look at this, the unraveling of so many norms and institutions and the expectations that we thought we could have reasonably had of how American democracy lumbers along, where are you on the, you know, kind of which orbit of pessimism and worry are you in? I mean, like there are people who I detect as being further out than me. I mean, with somebody like, you know, Timothy Snyder, who has just been connecting the dots to just a kind of more or less straight descent into tyranny for many years now, and has comments on this topic are almost always that shrill. I would put someone like Ann Applebaum at a kind of a lower orbit, but still, you know, quite concerned and just seeing how the dominoes are falling, you know, quite predictably. How worried are you that, you know, 3 years, 3.5 years is more than enough time to unravel more or less everything we value and would otherwise be disposed to take for granted in American democracy.
I'm a believer that you have to, it's not wrong to think like a pessimist, but you must act like an optimist. Hmm. And you should have due modesty about your personal role in the scheme of things, which is infinitesimally tiny, but you should act as if everything in the scheme of things depended on what you personally do. And I'm not a big believer in having opinions about the future. It's the future. I'm a believer in having opinions about the things that you as an individual can and should do. And so, I don't know, maybe Tim Snyder's right, but I'm going to act as if what I do in the here and now really, really matters. Again, without being a megalomaniac, I know it doesn't, but I know if a million of us believe that what we do in the here and now matters, that will matter a lot.
Yeah. Well, David, it's always great to talk to you. It's always an education.
Thank you.
Where should people find you? We've mentioned your podcast, The David Frum Show, over at The Atlantic. That's where I tend to read you. I can't remember where else you might publish, but is basically The Atlantic your home now for everything?
The Atlantic is my principal home. That's where almost all of my writing appears. They are kindly producing the new podcast, which launched in April. I do a few other things in other places where I talk about, it's basically Canadian topics that The Atlantic doesn't cover as closely. Right. But The Atlantic is my main place. And I still, despite everything, remain active on X or Twitter, although my heart breaks. It's like walking into a town that's had a hurricane hit it and just think, you know, this park used to be so beautiful, and now it's covered with broken bottles.
Yes, the hurricane hit it, and only the anti-Semites survived. Yeah, well, you're welcome to it. Let me know how it goes.
You're a wiser man than I am. But you have this great inner balance that keeps you, I think, from
But part of that balance is not going to not spend any time on X. So,
All right.
But listen, it's great to talk to you, David. Keep it up, and we will. We'll take the temperature of this thing at the predictable intervals, and I look forward to it.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.